I'd like to start this morning with an honest question. Does anyone actually know where the generation lines are delineated? Because I did a little bit of research online and there's some debate, but it seems to be a sort of common consensus that if you were born in the 1940s through to about the mid-1960s, that makes you a baby boomer. If you were born in the mid-60s through to the late 70s, that makes you Generation X. 1980 through to 2000, and you're a millennial, that's me. And the latest generation is anyone born after the year 2000. That's Generation Z. Forgive the American pronunciation. But it kind of makes you wonder where we're headed name-wise, right? The last few haven't been super imaginative, X, Y, and Z. And it kind of makes you think where we're going to go after this. Doesn't leave much room for expansion. But anyway, so Generation Z, they're colloquially known as Zoomers. And I didn't know that either until I did a little bit of research. But this is the generation that has never been without easy access to the internet and the ever more sophisticated technology that enables that access. And it's this constant easy access to the vast amounts of information on the internet. Not just that, the people, the vast amount of people that use it that has enabled the rise of the woke generation. See, this is the generation that is hyper aware of social injustices. This is the generation that is immersed in particular causes, right? They're moving away from using plastic because, you know, we've all seen those pictures of sea turtles with beer can holders around their necks. We're moving away from sugar towards eating healthier. I don't know if you guys have seen those Australian government ads about sugar. They are revolting, quite impactful. But generally, there's this attitude evolving of questioning the old ways of doing things, of wokeness. This is a culture that places supreme value on individual freedom and its expression. And it's a culture that questions everything and critically cross-examines all sources of authority. So with that in mind, it's no wonder that Tim Keller, in his book, The Reason for God, it's available at our resource board, and I highly recommend it. But in this book, he identifies that one of the major objections to Christianity is that it is total selfless obedience to an invisible God that critically undermines individual and societal freedom, and it makes being true to oneself, which is a hallmark of this culture, impossible. See, the question that gets asked is why? Why should I obey a God who only seems to take from me? Why should I obey a God who has compiled a long list of thou shalts and thou shalt nots? Why should I obey a God that I can't even see, who there is no empirical evidence for? No, thank you, not for me. What right does this God have to tell me how to live my life? And if that's you sitting here today, I want you to know that I get it. I understand that. I understand where you're coming from. I've been there myself. I haven't always been a Christian, and everything I have just said, I have believed myself personally at one point in my life. What I want to share with you today is something that I have come to realize, that God has every right to have a say in how we live our lives. In fact, he has a right not just to have a say, but to be in charge of how we live our lives. And it genuinely is in our best interests to listen carefully to what he has to say. So in our passage, we're going to see that God is, it should come up on the screen, God is the ultimate owner in verses 1 to 2, but we reject his rulership and try to take it for ourselves in verses 3 to 7. And if you continue to reject him by holding on to your ownership, you will lose everything. That's verses 8 to 12. So firstly, God is the ultimate owner. Now, I'll just give you a bit of context for our passage today. This passage in Mark chapter 12 comes directly after an exchange between Jesus and the current religious leaders of Israel. In Mark chapter 12, the previous chapter, right at the end, the religious leaders challenge Jesus and his authority. They ask him, "By what authority are you doing these things? Or who gave you the authority to do them?" They're asking, "What are you doing, Jesus? Why? Why are you upsetting the status quo? Why are you telling us how to live our lives and relate to our God? We are the experts. Who do you think you are?" Now, I use Generation Z as an example of a culture that questions authority, but it's really unfair for me to single them out, because here we see 2,000-year-old evidence of the fact that questioning God's authority in our lives is ingrained in our nature as human beings. And this parable that Jesus tells is a response to their questioning of his authority. Now, our story starts with a man who is building a vineyard. Look at verses 1 and 2. This man has planted the vines, he's dug the pit where the grapes will be pressed into wine, and he's built a watchtower and a fence around his property to protect it. He's done all the hard work, right? It's by the sweat of his brow, and it's through his finances that this vineyard has come to be. So to deny that this is the owner of his vineyard would be crazy, right? No one's going to do that. Of course it's his. He created it. And it would have been no small investment either. Like in the economic terms of those days, we're not thinking a hovel and a hole in the ground. It's more an expansive mansion in the Swan Valley. His money paid for the land. His money paid for the infrastructure. His labor constructed it. There is no doubt that the vineyard and everything attached to it belongs to this man. And we see that after he's built his vineyard, he goes away to another country on unspecified business and finds some tenants to lease his property from him. Now, the word lease there tells me that there is some sort of contractual obligation between the owner and his tenants. So understandably, in verse 2, when the owner sends a servant to collect his share of the profits from those who are leasing his vineyard at harvest time, it doesn't seem unreasonable. I doubt there's anyone reading this going, man, what a scoundrel, right? What right does he have to go and seek payment from those who are working his vineyard? No. Of course it makes sense. It's totally reasonable. He's leased his vineyard to tenants who are contractually obliged to share with him the profits of his own vineyard. Now this view, this image of the vineyard isn't new. There is Old Testament precedent for this, especially in Isaiah chapter 5, as a metaphor for the nation and the people of Israel. So the people listening to Jesus talk would have sat up, their ears would have pricked, and they would have gone, he's talking about us here. Have a look with me at verses 1 and 2 of chapter 5 of Isaiah. Let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. And he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. This is God singing over his people, his creation, his precious possession. And look at how tender that language is. It's a love song concerning his vineyard. He has labored among it, his people, digging, clearing of stones, planting choice vines. He's built a wine press and a watchtower to protect them, and now he looks forward to the harvest that he should rightfully expect. And that's not all. In Psalm 24, we see an expansion of this idea. Have a look at verses 1 and 2 of Psalm 24. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. The creation belongs to the Creator. The Creator has a right to be involved in his creation because he is the Creator. It all belongs to him. And even though the owner has graciously leased the vineyard to his tenants and they are working it, he has every right to expect to share in the profits because it remains his vineyard. So what does this mean for us? Well, really, it doesn't matter what your stance is on God. It doesn't matter what you believe about how we all came to be here, whether you believe our version of events or not. It doesn't matter how you think any of this vast, amazing web of life came into being. Everybody, no matter what your viewpoint, must logically acknowledge the possibility of the existence of a creator God. We have to acknowledge at least the possibility that it has all happened by design and that a transcendent creator God is at the root of it all. Because as much as there's no way to watertight prove the existence of God, there is no way to absolutely disprove his existence either. So logically, it must at least be possible, right? Now, if it is possible, if it is true that a transcendent creator God does exist, then we must acknowledge that we, as his creation, must owe everything to him because none of it is ours. Everything we have, everything we are, is the ultimate property of the one who created the universe and everything in it at the most fundamental level. If God is who he says he is, the creator of the universe, then he has every right to be what he also says he is, the ruler over his own creation. And that includes us. But, and there is a big but, we don't like this. So we don't like the fact that even though we do owe everything to a creator God, none of us, not one of us sitting here, live like this. None of us like to acknowledge that everything we have and everything we are is the gift of a generous God. And it's not easy to accept because if everything we are and everything we have is given to us by a God, then we aren't responsible for any of it, and we are at best tenants in our own lives and of everything in them. And we're not happy with that. It's not enough. We want to rule. We want to be owners. And so even though God is the ultimate owner, we reject his rulership and try to take it for ourselves. Now, the idea of an absentee landlord and disputes over land between owners and tenants would have been quite common in those days. And even now, it's easy to see, looking at this story, how it could happen. Imagine with me, right? You've moved into this amazing vineyard. Everything's been done. All the work has been done. The house has been built. The wine vat has been dug. The vines have been planted. All that you have to do, really, is keep it alive, keep the vines alive until harvest time. And the owner goes away, and he leaves you to it. Now it comes time to harvest, and you start thinking, well, where is he? Where is the owner? It's been months, and we haven't seen him. He hasn't done any of the work. Why should we pay him? Why should he get a share in the harvest? And that's exactly what the tenants do. They beat the servant the owner sends for his share, and they send him away empty-handed. Now, my wife and I have just moved out of a rental property, and one of the shocks of adult life were these things called rent inspections. Now, for those of you who don't yet know, still in blissful ignorance, every 3 to 4 months, someone officious with a clipboard and a long list comes from the rental agency, and they run their finger over every surface. They inspect all the blinds for dust, and I'm not making this up. They make sure that the windows are free of smudges. I couldn't believe it when I read that. Smudges on windows. And these are just three things among many. But as tenants, we had to be totally subservient, right? There was no option to take our rental man when he came to inspect, beat him, and send him away. Although, I'll be honest, I really did think about it once or twice. Because, I mean, who cleans individual blinds, honestly? But for these tenants to treat the owner's servant this way was also crazy. I mean, surely the owner's going to come back and take what's rightfully his, right? How long do you think this little show of rebellion can go on for? Well, as it turns out, quite a while. Have a look at verses 4 and 5. Again, he sent them another servant, and they struck him on the head and treated him shamefully. And he sent another, and him they killed. And so with many others. Some they beat, some they killed. He doesn't come in guns blazing. He doesn't come back and immediately take what is rightfully his. He shows incredible patience and grace to those who have wronged him. But finally, the owner is out of options. There's no one else to send but his son, his beloved son. Look at verse 6. He sent him to them saying, "They will respect my son." Does this seem crazy to you? I was reading through this and I went, what? Imagine you're the owner and you've sent your servants to collect payment from these crazy tenants and they've done terrible things to them. Are you now going to send your son? What do you think they're going to do to him? And sure enough, the tenants react exactly how we imagine that they're going to. They rub their hands together and they say, "This is it. Here is our chance." Look at verses 7 and 8. "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and the inheritance will be ours." And they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. And here we get to the heart of the issue. Here we see this attitude of, "I want your stuff, but I don't want you. I want the gifts, but I don't want the giver. I don't want to be beholden to anyone. I don't want to have to share the profits. I don't want relationship with you. I don't want to be a tenant. I want to be the owner." And this is the face of sin. This is what sin looks like, and it is ugly. This rebellion against the ownership of our Creator God, to whom we owe everything, this stubborn, foolish, and violent rebellion as we reject His right to rule in our lives and we try to seize His crown for ourselves. This is what Adam and Eve did in the garden when they looked at that forbidden tree and they thought, "I want that more than I want relationship with God." This is what Jacob does when he lies to his father and steals the blessing and inheritance that was always meant to be his older brother's. And this is what David did, standing on the roof of his palace, the man who had everything. And he saw Bathsheba, another man's wife, and he said to himself, "What I have is not enough. I want that. I have to have that. I'm going to take it. And no one is going to stop me." This is what the Pharisees are doing with God's beloved people. They're not content to be stewards of his people, but they're determined to wrestle that rulership from him. And this is what we all do in our lives. We strive to take the throne of God and to say to him, "Not your way, no, I'm going to do it my way." This is the purpose of the entire parable. Jesus is speaking to us as God's beloved son. He's speaking to us as those who have not listened to God, who have not respected the will of the owner and creator. He's speaking to us as those who were not content to be tenants, who had to be owners. An incredible irony here, I can't help but laugh at it, is that the inheritance that we're all trying to so hard to seize for ourselves, an inheritance that we're all working so hard to grasp and hold onto, the kingdom that we are willing to kill the Son of God for, can be ours freely through the very man we're trying to kill, Jesus. The beloved Son isn't coming to exact payment from the tenants. He's not coming with fire and brimstone and judgment. No, he's coming to make us co-heirs with him. He's saying to us, this is how you receive the full blessing of God's inheritance as his children. Stop trying to do it on your own. Stop making the mistakes of the Old Testament. Stop trying to earn it. Stop trying to work for it. Stop trying to seize it for yourselves. Stop rejecting everything I tell you and listen to what I have to say. Accept me and the free inheritance that I am offering you. See, this is what Jesus came to do through the cross. Jesus welcomes those who are hostile to God, who are his enemies, those who are seeking to kill him. He welcomes them and he offers them a place alongside himself as an heir to the Father's kingdom. He takes those who were enemies and makes them children of God. But accepting Jesus and the inheritance that he offers means submitting to his rulership. And for some, that's a step too far. That's too difficult. I mean, you've heard the expression, "I'd rather rule in hell than serve in heaven." See, this isn't one of those you kill the king, you become the king stories. Whenever we reject our Creator God, whenever we foolishly strive with him for rulership, only tragedy awaits. The only way to take hold of the inheritance of God is to receive the Son and the glorious inheritance of forgiveness and love that he freely offers us. Stop trying to kill him and submit to his rule. Because if we continue to reject him by holding on to your ownership, you will lose everything. So now we come, finally, to the end of the story. The tenants have killed the owner's son. They've rejected every attempt by the owner to reconcile with them. And they remain defiant, stubbornly insisting on their own right to rule. Now, finally, the owner stirred to action. Look at verse 9. Jesus asks, "What will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others." Finally, the owner acts in anger and judgment on those who have defied him for so long. The show has come to an end. These tenants have rejected every attempt by the owner to reconcile with him. They continue, determined to continue fighting him for his vineyard. And the owner justly comes and destroys them. Again, this doesn't seem unreasonable in the context of the story. What's really unreasonable is how far the owner was willing to go to be reconciled with them. And this vineyard that they fought so hard to keep was stripped from them and given to others. Isn't it tragic? So the big question that we have to ask ourselves now at the end of this parable is, who are you? Where do you fit into this little cast of characters? See, the thing is, we are all bad tenants of what God has graciously given us. We all fail at submitting to the ultimate owner. We all convince ourselves that we're fit to rule, far more fit than the absentee landlord. And God has been so patient with us. He's tolerated our rebellion for far longer than we deserve, that we're here at all. But more than that, that we can enjoy the blessings of his creation while we're in open rebellion to him is testament to his incredible love and patience. And yet in each one of our lives, there comes a crucial moment when you meet God's beloved son. When you see him coming, this, the father's final attempt at reconciliation, what will you do? See, there's only two choices. There's only two ways we can go. We can continue in our rebellion, holding fast onto what we have seized for ourselves and pretending, deceiving ourselves that we really are truly the kings over what God alone has a right to rule, and so lose everything we're striving for. Or we can let go of all our claims to ownership in our lives, recognize that only God is fit to rule over his creation, submit to his ownership, and so receive the glorious inheritance that Jesus offers. Now, you might be sitting here thinking, I'm not sure that I like what I'm hearing. I've heard a lot about sacrifice. I've heard a lot about submitting myself to God, about giving up my right to rule. This sounds like a lot of give. What do we really get? And this is the beautiful thing about Christianity. This is the beautiful thing about the gospel of Jesus Christ. God doesn't ask us to give up everything for nothing. He asks us to give up all claims of ownership in our lives so that we can share his perfect kingdom with him. God isn't just the rightful ruler over his creation. He's a better ruler. He's the perfect ruler. And this was the rub for me, right? It was only when I started to see what an absolute mess I was making of my life, what a disastrous road I was walking down, did I realize that I needed a better ruler. It was only when I saw how unfit I was to rule that giving up my claims of ownership over my own life didn't seem crazy to me anymore. In fact, it was actually a relief to give myself over to rulership of the only one who is fit to rule. And this is the uncomfortable truth when it comes to who is king in our lives. As C.S. Lewis puts it, and I love this quote, "We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased." See, Christians, more so than anyone else, are slaves to God. To be a Christian means you know how little you really deserve from God, how desperately you need a savior, how desperately you need a way out of the mess that you have made. Christians are those people who humbly accept Christ's offer of love and reconciliation, who rejoice in him taking our sin and its consequences on himself, paying the enormous debt that our rebellion to God has incurred. To be a Christian means to give up the empty, hollow things that we are clinging to in our lives, to stop making mud pies in the slum, and to accept what Jesus is offering us, the infinite joy that is on offer to us. So are you doing that? Are you doing that? If you call yourself a Christian here this morning, are you giving up the things that you think you can't live without? Things that you are holding on to rulership over? Is money, security, reputation, pride, even our livelihoods, our jobs, even our lives. What are you holding on to? Are you saying to Jesus, all of this is yours, none of it is mine? You alone have the right to give or take, and whatever you do, whatever you bless me with, or whatever you take away from me, I will praise you because I am not my own. I belong to you, and you are good. You are good. Are you bearing fruit for God's kingdom? Are you sharing your faith with as many people as you can? Is this news so good that you can't keep it to yourself? Or are you hoarding the inheritance that God has offered you and holding it jealously? And if you're meeting Jesus for the first time today, do you see how good he is? We're going to sing a song in a minute, and there's a line in that song that I love. From a throne of endless glory to a cradle in the dirt. Do you see the king that came down to us, that entered into our mess and rebellion and has given us a way out? Do you see Jesus, who's taken our mud pies in the slum so that we could receive the endless glory that only he truly deserves? Do you see how far he was willing to go to save you from yourself? We have to respond to the Son. We can't ignore him. What will your response be? Will you let go of your tiny little kingdom to gain everything? Will you stop killing your inheritance? Jesus, the man Jesus. And will you accept the eternal life that he offers?